The morning breaks into music. Music that shines like a sunrise. Music that sings like a bird in a dawn chorus tree. The day tunes up like an orchestra might for the classical start to the day on BBC Radio 3. Breakfast, weekday mornings from 6:30. Listen on Radio 3 and BBC Sounds.
Now on Radio 3 and BBC Sounds, we look ahead to International Women's Day next Friday with this week's edition of the Early Music Show, introduced by Lucy Skeeping.
Anonymous Estampie, performed there by members of a fascinating group of musicians and storytellers who are celebrating their 15th anniversary this year and have a diary packed with gigs all over the country to prove it. They're called The Telling. And on today's programme, I'm joined by the group's director and founder, Claire Norburn. Claire, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So it seems to me that The Telling is really quite a unique group of performers. Who are you all and what do you offer to audiences that's different?
Well, what we offer to audiences that are different are performances that are more than just a concert, either with candlelight or even with proper lighting design, with a wonderful lighting designer called Natalie Rowland, and very often with a play, which is not polite readings. It's much more than that. It's fully staged. We work with BAFTA-nominated director Nicholas Renton, and pulling that all together to something where the music and the theatre collide in interesting ways and bounce off each other. That all takes time to put together and lots of rehearsals, so it's quite an expensive business.
Yeah, I can see it must take time and indeed money. How did the group come about initially?
I've always had a great love of medieval music. That's always been right from when I finished my studies. I sort of fell into medieval music because I was a singer first and foremost. That's how we started. But the whole idea of The Telling and putting together music and theatre really came back from a time when I was working closely with Deborah Roberts, the co-artistic director at Brighton Early Music Festival, which she and I together co-founded and co-ran. I did that for 15 years. She's still there, still making it all happen. But what we were trying to do there was to try and find interesting ways to demystify early music, particularly some repertoire of medieval music, for example, the troubadour music, which I know we're going to go on and talk about, which is very codified, quite hard to unpack. And we wanted to find a way of looking at a sort of cross-art form collaborations to demystify early music in a non-academic way, having at its root an understanding of the academic background, but actually using other art forms to try and widen the net of people who might like this music.
A 13th century song from Blanche of Castile there, performed by The Telling, with soloist Ariana Prusner. Now, Claire Norbin, what do we know of Blanche of Castile? Was she a Queen of France, I think, but evidently a composer as well?
She was. She was the wife of Louis VIII of France. She was even actually regent when he died, and her son was not yet old enough to take up the reins, so she was a very powerful woman. But yes, she also is attributed to that piece. Like many of the women in the Middle Ages, and there are a surprising number of both female trouvères and troubadours, or trobarits as they're known, we don't know a huge amount about them or about their compositions. What we have is probably only a small snapshot of what their output.
That's a big part of your repertoire, isn't it, with The Telling?
It is, and I mean, it's a particular repertoire that's very close to my heart and is really not done very much in the UK, probably because of that reason, that it's quite codified. The songs are kind of full of ancient references that we don't entirely understand, and also courtly love traditions, which are kind of potentially quite strange to us in terms of how we think about love today. But the songs are really wonderful, and they are effectively the earliest love songs, or some of the earliest love songs. So the first show I wrote was a show called Unsung Heroine, and it is about a woman troubadour, Beatrice de Dia. She is one of a group of women troubadourettes. There's about 30 or so poems which survive, including four by Beatrice, and there's one special one, which is the only poem to which we also have the music, and it's called Chantar. And it's an extraordinary song. It's about betrayal. And so I ended up sort of thinking, how could I give people a way into this repertoire? I thought I could take how she might come to write that song. Quite a lot of what the troubadours had to say about themselves was this idea that they were using their own life experiences to create art. So I've imagined that that song comes from a direct experience. There's a collection of what are called vidas, they're kind of biographies of the troubadours. The vidas for Beatrice doesn't tell us much about her, but it says that she's married to Guillaume de Poitiers and also was the lover of someone called Rainbow de Renga. There was a troubadour called Rainbow de Renga, and we don't know whether it's that troubadour, but I've imagined that it was, that actually, like many women, Beatrice was stuck in a loveless marriage, because women were married off very young. They were not love matches. That suddenly this man comes into her life, Rainbow de Renga, the great troubadour, and she has this both sexual and artistic connection with him, which unleashes this great outpouring of writing, although writing isn't quite the right word because she probably didn't write it down. She probably composed songs like singer-songwriters do in their bedrooms today, just kind of improvising and exploring and performing. It was a performing tradition.
Thank you.
a song by the 12th century poet and composer Beatrice of Dia, who features very heavily in a show devised by Claire Norburn and the telling called Unsung Heroine. Well, we've heard from Blanche of Castile and Beatrice of Dia so far. I realise that the focus on women is a very important part of your work. And Hildegard of Bingen also features heavily in your activities. She's enjoyed a really big revival, I guess, in the last couple of decades, if not more. What is it about her that's so fascinating?
Well, I think she's just an extraordinary woman. I mean, she's more than a composer. She probably wouldn't have thought of herself as a composer. She was a woman of God, first and foremost, but she used everything around her to imbue and communicate her message, and music was really very much a part of that. Eventually, she was kind of quite a good marketeer, I think you'd think of her as today. She uses the music as a way of communicating her message and realises that that's probably going to have much more impact than just banging on in the same kind of way. So my show about her, I've called it An Imagined Testimony. It's about trying to imagine what it would be like to be a woman who is bricked up into a cell at the age of 8, who has correspondence with the Pope and with very powerful people, who goes on and founds a monastery. She's kind of called by God to do that. That causes great consternation with the monks, where she's been actually residing for most of her life and until later in her life in her 40s. But also there's an extraordinary moment when she's 42 that I was fascinated with, where she, up to this point, has really not talked about her visions. She's kept it very quiet. She's obviously been quite scared, because we all know what happens to people who might have talked about having received visions. If that was not accepted by the church, you're in a very fragile place. You might end up like Joan of Arc 250 years later, dead. So she would have been very aware of that. And she finally, in her 42nd year, she talks about receiving a message from God that she cannot ignore anymore, to go out and communicate. And from that moment on, her life is dedicated to spreading the word. And I think the music is very much part of that command to spread the word. Thank you.
Music by Hildegard of Bingen there, performed by The Telling, with vocals from my guest today, Claire Norburn, and Ariana Prusner. You're listening to The Early Music Show on BBC Radio 3. I'm Lucy Skeeping, and on today's programme we're marking 15 years of the group The Telling and their dedication to celebrating the powerful and yet often unsung women of early music. Claire, we've heard from three women composers so far, and I know that those shows go back a few years in your touring history, but your current touring show is actually about an imaginary woman. Tell us something about that.
Yes, my show Into the Melting Pot is set in 1492, and it does tell the story of an imaginary Jewish woman on her last night in Seville around the time of the Spanish Reconquista. She is, like many people today, experiencing an enforced a need to leave her home and to flee her home because the Jews were basically given an ultimatum. 31st of July 1492, you had to be out or you had to convert. That was the choice. And I was always fascinated by that story and also the Sephardic tradition which comes out of 1492 as the Jewish diaspora kind of settled in Eastern Europe, Morocco, other places in North Africa and Turkey. But I also was fascinated by Spain before this because we think of the Middle Ages as a time of crusades, but in Spain we did have for a long time examples of Jewish, Christian and Muslim communities living side by side in relative harmony. That's not to say it was perfect and it wasn't liberal in today's understanding of liberalism, but the Jews had been in the Iberian Peninsula since about the 7th century, as had the Muslims. And the thought of those people who were being sent back to who knows where is what my play is about. And so I've contrasted the music of before, which is the music of particularly the Cantiques de Santa Maria, a very well-known collection, which I'm sure many of your listeners will know, which we know from iconography there were Jewish, Christian and Muslim musicians who contributed to that collection. So that's the before music, and the after music is the Sephardic tradition that comes out of 1492, which is sung in Ladino, a Spanish Jewish dialect, in fact.
Oh.
Morena Meyaman, they call me the Dark Girl, a traditional Sephardic song inspired by the Song of Songs from the Bible, performed there by The Telling. It's from their current touring production called Into the Melting Pot 1492. Claire, from what you were telling me just before that track, there are some comparisons to be drawn between the story of your fictional Jewish woman in that show and more recent refugee stories.
Absolutely. There are lots of contemporary relevances, and obviously the rise of anti-Semitism is one of those, sadly. But also the Windrush scandal, I think, is very, very relevant about people being sent back to where they come from, in quotes. And also stories of refugees forced to leave their homes in Ukraine, Afghanistan and now Gaza. We've actually done a refugee project. We've just been touring the last few weeks, and we worked with a brilliant animateur and the Refugee and Migrant Centre in Wolverhampton, working with people to tell their stories of migration through music, and music that was comforting to them, which is what Blanca does in the show. The music is her kind of comfort blanket to help her through this experience. They came to see the show, and many of them came afterwards and said how relevant they felt it and how moved they were by seeing the show.
The idea of whole communities being displaced, if you like, is so very relevant today, isn't it?
It is indeed, and we never ever perform it without somebody coming up and saying, this is my story, or this is my father's, mother's, grandparent's story, including people who have traced their ancestry back to 1492, but also stories of migration refugees who were forced out of their homes from all around the world. And in fact, Maya Levy, who is one of the Jewish singers we work with on this project, her grandparents spoke Ladino, the language, the dialect that the Sephardic songs are sung in. They used to use it as a kind of secret language so that the kids wouldn't understand what they were saying, she always talks about. And the next piece is going to be Maya singing a Sephardic song, Siete Hijos. This is a song about Hannah, the biblical story of Hannah and her seven sons who refused to convert and are therefore killed.
Siete hijos tiene Hannah, Hannah la buena judía, los mandó
An instrumental piece, one of the Cantigas de Santa Maria from medieval northern Spain. And before it, you heard a traditional Sephardic song, Sieta Hijos, sung there by Maya Levy with the instrumentalists of The Telling. That's taken from their current touring show, Into the Melting Pot, 1492. And Claire, I know there are still quite a few dates left, so where can people come and see you?
Yes, we've got a bit of a break, but then we're back in on May. We're going to Newbury Spring Festival on the 22nd of May, Halle St Peter's in Manchester on the 24th, Otley Courthouse in Leeds on the 25th, and we are closing the Beverley Early Music Festival on the 26th of May.
And what about other shows? Have you got anything up your sleeve at the moment?
Yes, we've got two tours coming up. One is our new show, The Telling Unchained, which is very informal. We take performances of medieval music and folk music into pub function rooms. And there are kind of no rules. We get the audience to join in with drinking songs. We take them on a journey and explain how we create the music from scratch, because a lot of the music that we are performing and that you will have heard today is often just a single line melody. So how do we get that and create a performance? And it's just very informal and great fun. And the other is I Spy, which is the story of John Dowland and his brush with the Elizabethan Secret Service.
That's a bit James Bond. Tell us a bit more, but no spoilers.
Yeah, indeed. This is an amazing story, and I'm kind of surprised that people haven't found out about it. I generally knew that Dowland was thought to possibly have been a spy, but then I read his biography by Diana Poulton, which is kind of the biography of John Dowland. And there's an amazing letter in there from Dowland in 1595 to Sir Robert Cecil, who at that stage had just taken over, or was one of the people vying to take over, the Secret Service, which had been founded by Francis Walsingham. And before the 16th century, we didn't have a Secret Service. It came in about really because of Elizabeth's worries about Catholic plots. And the interesting thing about Dowland is that he was Catholic. I mean, quietly Catholic, not a strident Catholic, but he was also somebody who travelled. And musicians through time have been thought to be in an interesting place where they could potentially be spies. And Dowland, it is thought, really probably would have gone to Sir Robert Cecil wanting to travel. And part of the deal would be, we'll give you your papers, but keep your eyes and ears open. And that's probably what happened to Dowland. And Dowland did keep his eyes and ears open, and he was approached by an English expat Catholic priest in Rome. And clearly this was going some kind of plot. So he writes to Sir Robert Cecil and says, I've uncovered this plot, and explains what has happened. The slightly problematic thing about it is that he takes quite a long time to do so. So I've kind of interpreted and imagined what it was like to be a Catholic informer where you are not trusted and could end up dead, really, and how Dowland kind of fits into that. And of course, it's a wonderful excuse to have lots of amazing music by Dowland as well.
You would have thought it was safer to stick to the lute, even if not so well paid, wouldn't you?
Indeed.
Now, I know you brought a track with you from that Dowland show, and this is from a performance you gave on Radio 4's Front Row, isn't it?
It is indeed, yes. So this is the amazing song. I think it's one of my favourite Dowland songs, Time Stands Still.
Cupid doth haunt. and fortune captive at her feet, condemned and conquered lies. Cupid doth hover down, blinded by her fair eyes, and fortune captive at her feet, condemned and conquered lies.
That was John Dowland's Time Stands Still, sung there by Claire Norburn with Jamie Acres on the lute. That was from their touring production called I Spy, the story of John Dowland's brush with the Elizabethan Secret Service. And Claire, I think you've got another big tour coming up shortly.
Yes, indeed. This is the next tour of I Spy, which is happening in June, and we are going to lots of places that don't really get early music. That's one of the things that we try and do. So we're going to Cumbria, Lancaster, Glasgow, Stranraer, Bedford, Colchester, Stratford-on-Avon.
There is lots of early music there. I wonder
why. Conwy in North Wales, Cardiff, London, Folkestone and Liverpool. So lots of places.
Fantastic. Well, we'll be back in about 3 minutes or so for more from Claire Norburn. But first, here's Mark Siow with this week's edition of the Early Music News.
Thanks, Lucy. I'm Mark Siow and this week's Early Music News is all about Jephthah. No, not Handel's famous oratorio, but instead a piece of the same name by lesser-known English composer Maurice Greene. Almost 300 years on from its composition, early opera company are putting on Jephthah at London's Middle Temple Hall, a stone's throw from the Devil's Tavern on Fleet Street, where the oratorio was first performed. As early opera company have put it, this is a rare performance of a magnificent work not to be missed. Here's the conductor, Christian Kernan, to tell us what we can expect from their production.
I first heard Jephthah about 10 years ago when a friend sent me a recording made by the BBC for the 300th anniversary of Maurice Greene's death. I'd never heard any of Greene's music, and I was really struck by how beautiful the score was and also how strong the story was. It's much more simple, more concise and darker than Handel's setting. For instance, it has just four characters, of which only Jephthah is named. The others are simply referred to as Daughter and Elder 1 and 2. Part 1 is jubilant and warlike, with the elders of Gilead pleading with Jephthah to come out of exile and fight against the Ammonites. But Part 2 is the dramatic heart of the oratorio, and is mostly a dialogue between Jephthah and his daughter as they try to come to terms with the consequence of Jephthah's vow. Greene expertly paints the conflicting emotions of the two protagonists through increasing pathos in their arias, culminating in a stunning lament for the daughter as she asks for a brief reprieve to bewail her virgin state. It's great that we perform and record Handel and Purcell so much, but here in Britain, unlike, say, in France, where their operatic heritage is so celebrated, we're not so great in celebrating our own homegrown composers. 18th century Britain was awash with talent, composers like Thomas Arne, William Boyce, John Stanley, Thomas Linley, and indeed Maurice Greene, amongst many others, all deserve to be better known. I really hope our recording of Jephthah might in some small way encourage people to perform and record not just Greene's music, but other 18th century British composers. It really is a treasure trove.
Christian Kernan there, and Early Opera Company's performance of Jephthah by Maurice Greene comes to London's Middle Temple Hall on Monday, the 11th of March. And a highlight coming up this week here on Radio 3. Saturday evening brings us not one, but two operas by Henry Purcell, Dido and Aeneas and The Fairy Queen, performed by Lézard Florissant and conductor William Christie. The mezzo-soprano and recent Radio 3 New Generation artist Helen Charleston stars as the lamenting Dido. That's this Saturday, the 9th of March at 6:30 p.m. And that's your early music news.
Thanks, Mark, and there'll be more early music news next week. Now, Claire Norburn is still with me, and Claire, our next track is somewhat unseasonal. But I know you wanted to share the Telling's Christmas album with us because it was actually rather a hit, wasn't it?
It was, yes. We released a Secret Life of Carols album. It got to 25 in the classical charts and was played on David Mellor's show. He said it was his favourite carol album. So we were very pleased with that.
Which we're going to hear now.
Yeah, this is Lulai Lulai, Aus Ilion Julis Nicht. And I love this song because it's a medieval carol, but it's a take of the story of the Annunciation, but it's actually Jesus as a baby saying to his mother, sing me a song, you're supposed to do this, that's what all good mothers do. And she kind of replies saying, I don't know what to sing to you, but I'm going to tell you this story. So it's kind of a very human kind of context that very famous story is told in, which I love.
The meltingly beautiful Christmas carol Lulay Lulay, sung there by Claire Norburn and Ariana Prusner, from the Telling's very successful album, The Secret Life of Carols, released in 2019. Now, Claire, I know you're marking 15 years of the Telling this year, but what about the next 15 years? Are you looking ahead to the future?
Not to 15 years worth, I think. It's hard to know what will happen beyond a couple of years. But my real focus increasingly is as a playwright and producer. I've only really discovered my writing through writing for the Telling, and I've only been writing for 10 years. And it's such a joy to do that and to find a new way of presenting music in a way that reaches audiences in quite exciting ways. I'm actually coming to terms also with hearing loss at the moment, which I've had for a while, but it's getting more and more challenging to sing. So I'm starting to bow out of my singing over the next year. I'm going to carry on as I am for now, but I have plans to do less and less and focus more on the writing and producing. as hearing loss for a musician is a kind of taboo subject, it's also something I'd like to write about. The statistics on hearing loss are about 1 in 6 people suffer hearing loss in some way, shape or form. And musicians are not going to be exempt from that kind of statistic, yet it's something that many people can't talk about. And I have been told that I will, in due course, be profoundly deaf. So this, I think, is my future, and I want to write about it too.
Well, I'm really sorry to hear that, but it sounds to me like you're doing all the right things and taking the right attitude. But it must be difficult to come to terms with, particularly for someone whose world is so much sort of focusing on sound, as it were.
Yes. Sadly, the thing that's the biggest challenge for me is not sitting and having a conversation with you in a nice quiet space. That's fine. I can manage that without any problem. But singing is one of the most challenging things that I have to do, because I hear the sound inside me, as I normally would do, but I have constant tinnitus in one ear, and the receptors of the other musicians I'm singing with coming back to me is massively reduced. So often I find it very, very hard to hear and tune, to make sure that I'm in tune and in time, which is just a sadness, really.
Well, we wish you lots of luck for the future, not only for your own health and well-being, of course, but for the musical and dramatic future of your group, The Telling. It's been a real pleasure to chat to you, Claire. Now, we're going to close with one final track from your current touring show, Into the Melting Pot, yes. 1492. What have you chosen for us?
This is a lovely, really upbeat. It's from the Canticas de Santa Maria, number 57, I believe, and it's called Muy Grandes Noite Dia. It's the story of a woman who is on pilgrimage to Montserrat. She's not very clever. She decides to go with all her gold and finery and lay out a big picnic feast. And that's really unwise, because Raimundo, the wicked robber knight, comes down and sends them all fleeing in terror. She loses all her finery, all her everything. She still gets to Montserrat. She rushes into the chapel and says, "Avenge me for this wrong that's been done to me." And sure enough, the robbers choke on the chicken bones of the meal that they've stolen, and they are blinded, and they vow never to rob again and become good Christians. So a typical story from the Canticas de Santa Maria. You can't resist it, really.
We're gonna make it.
one of the cantigas for Santa Maria, performed there by The Telling from their current touring production called Into the Melting Pot 1492. The early music show was presented by Lucy Skeeping, and she was joined by The Telling's founder and director, Claire Norburn. The programme was produced in Salford by Les Pratt.
What makes a great piece of film music?
I feel it has to be a part of the entertainment.
At this special time of year for film, next Sunday, BBC Radio 3 will be honouring some unforgettable scores throughout the ages, with an entire day of music for the big screen. From Sunday breakfast to a special afternoon programme with me, Isabel Waller-Bridge, you can hear some familiar film favourites and also discover what's next for film composition.
We sort of secretly feel this duty to keep the orchestra alive.
Sound of Cinema Sunday. Listen on Radio 3 and BBC Sounds.
It's 3 o'clock. Now on Radio 3, it's Choral Evensong, first broadcast live on Wednesday from Winchester Cathedral. The canticles are the Collegium Regale, a setting of the Evening Canticles, written for King's College, Cambridge, by Herbert Howells. The anthem is Edward Burstow's Lord, Thou Hast Been Our Refuge. The service opens with an introit by Richard Farrant, Call to Remembrance.